Thinking about what we might talk about this morning, I think especially about our young people. A lot of them sit over here in this section, but of course we have young people all through the audience. I think the book of Ecclesiastes is especially relevant to people today, young and old alike, in fact, but especially applicable to our younger people. In this particular book, the preacher doesn't identify himself by name, but just refers to him as the preacher, as you can see in chapter 1, verse 1. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. It talks about his experience in life and what he's learned as a result of his experience in life. The traditional view is that Solomon is the author. And of course, there are some statements in the book itself that would lead us to that conclusion. For example, chapter 1 in verse 1 refers to him as king in Jerusalem and a son of David. Chapter 1, verse 12, I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem. And so he's a king. He's a descendant of David, at least, if not directly his son. And so all of that would fit Solomon. And then in verse 16 of chapter 1, I said to myself, behold, I have magnified and increased in wisdom more than all who are over Jerusalem before me, and my mind has observed a wealth of wisdom and knowledge. And that's certainly true of Solomon. And so even though the name Solomon is not found in the book, traditionally people have attributed it to him. And so during the course of the lesson, I might refer to him as the preacher, as he refers to himself in the book, or I might refer to him as Solomon. If it's written by Solomon, it perhaps was written by him at the end of his life. And we know the story of Solomon, how he was the son of David and how he became king, how God blessed him and he increased in wisdom and power and wealth and all of those things. But he married a number of pagan women, women from idolatrous societies, and they drew his heart away from God, and he actually began to participate with them in their pagan worship. And so he strayed away from God and became unfaithful. Well, perhaps toward the end of his life, after reflecting on that life, he writes this book and talks about not only his drifting away, but also his return to respect for God and allegiance and loyalty to God. I suppose that's a little bit of reading between the lines, but we'll just offer that as at least a possible explanation of the setting for the book. Look at the very beginning of the book, chapter 1 and verse 2, where he says, vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Solomon here is making a comment about life as it is viewed from an earthly perspective. He's not looking at this as an Israelite who is thinking about the Word of God and think about the revelation of God, or certainly not as a Christian. He lives way before the time of Christ, thinking about life from the perspective of a Christian. But he's looking at it from an earthly point of view. He uses the expression life under the sun, or under the sun, a number of times. For example, chapter 1, verse 3. What advantage does man have in all his work which he does under the sun? And so while he's here on earth, what advantage is hard work to a man while he's living his life on the earth? Verse 9, that which has been is that which will be, and that which has been done is that which will be done. There is nothing new under the sun. And so from this worldly perspective, from an earthly perspective, there's nothing new. Everything that is done today has been done in the past, and everything that will be done has already been done. And so look at verse 14. I've seen all the works which have been done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and striving after the wind. And so again, he's talking about life under the sun, or life from an earthly or this worldly perspective. Those are just three times we find this phrase, under the sun. We actually find it several more times. For example, we won't take the time to read all of these. Chapter 2, verses 11, 17, 18, 19, 20, and 22. And so, again, he's considering life, trying to make an evaluation of life from this perspective. He's lived a life under the sun. He's lived a worldly life, a very earth-centered life. And he's going to tell us about his conclusions about life based on that experience. In fact, in chapter 1 and verse 2, he tells us what that conclusion is. He says, "Vanity of vanities, all is vanity." And so his conclusion is, I'm not exactly sure what I did there, but there we go. His conclusion is that if you just look at life from an earthly perspective, it's all vain. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. The expression vanity of vanities, that means it's the greatest vanity. It's vain to the greatest degree. The Song of Songs is the greatest song. A Hebrew of Hebrews is, you know, that's the cream of the crop among the Hebrews. That's the greatest Hebrew, or the greatest Hebrews. And so vanity of vanities is just expression emphasizing that quality that he finds true of life if it is lived and looked at from an earthly perspective, from under the sun. The word vanity covers, like lots of all words, I suppose, a range of meaning. Means emptiness, meaninglessness, absurdity, what is improper or transitory in nature, are just worthless. And so that's what life is. It's meaningless. If all there is to life is what we experience under the sun, well, it's really worthless. It's meaningless. It's absurd. You know, when you look at life around us and see all the injustice in the world, you just say, that's crazy. What's going on? It just doesn't make any sense. And so if you just look at life in that way, that's the conclusion that he reached. And there's a lot of truth to that. If we look at the world around us, and you watch the news, if you keep up with things that are going on currently at all, you do come away scratching your head and wondering, what is the point in living a life if all we produce in life is just this? There's certainly no sense in living a life of self-restraint and self-denial and self-control if this is all there is. The rich get richer, the poor get poorer. The rich get richer at the expense of and by taking advantage of the poor. That's just not right. Power and wealth are the possessions of evil men, while good men are oppressed. You see that in the world around us. Power, that's in the hands of evil men. Here are good men, they're trying to do what's right, and they just get rolled over by those who are in power. There's injustice and corruption all around us. Death is the common lot of all men. So why do all the things that we put our time and energy into if we're going to all die in the end? Wise men and fools, rich and poor, lazy and hardworking. We're all going to die in the end. And so what's the use? We're going to take none of our accomplishments or acquisitions with us. And when we leave them behind, they might be left under the control of people that are fools, and they waste it all. Why should I put all my life and all my work and all my effort into accumulating or building something up when I can't take it with me, and the person that I have to leave it to, he's just going to squander it? And so it's vanity. It's empty. It's meaningless. It's futile. It's absurd. That's the conclusion that he reached when looking at life from an earthly perspective, or life under the sun. He says in chapter 1 that we're caught in an endless repetitive cycle. And so what is happening now has happened before. And things will not change. Things are not going to get better. Now we live in an age which has been influenced in lots of ways by the theory of evolution. Things get better. Things improve. We're moving up the scale or up the ladder. But if you look at life, especially from this perspective, that's not the case at all. Things are not getting any better. And what's going on now is what has gone on in the past. And so, look at verse 3. What advantage does man have in all his work which he does under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. Also, the sun rises and the sun sets, and hastening to its place, it rises there again, blowing toward the south and turning toward the north. The wind continues swirling along on its circular courses. The wind returns. All the rivers flow into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place where the rivers flow, there they flow again. All things are wearisome. Man is not able to tell it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor is the ear filled with hearing. That which has been is that which will be. And that which has been done is that which will be done. So there is nothing new under the sun. We're caught in this endless, repetitive cycle. The same thing happens over and over again. My generation makes the same mistakes that the previous generation made, and they made the same mistakes that the previous generation made. And so it's vanity, it's absurdity, it's meaningless. As if we were to look at life just from an earthly point of view. And so the preacher sets out on a search for something that might make life worth living. What can I do? What can I find in life? Since I see that it all seems to be meaningless and absurd and worthless, what can I do that will make life worth meaning? And he turns to three different experiences or three different activities. The first thing he does is he sets out in the pursuit of pleasure. And so look at chapter 2, verse 1. I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure, so enjoy yourself. And so I'm going to just live life to the fullest. I'm going to enjoy life. I'm not going to withhold anything that I would like to have that I might, you know, might use to experience some kind of enjoyment or pleasure. I'm rich. I've got the time to do it. And so that's what I'm going to do. In fact, in verse 10, he says, all that my eyes desired, I did not refuse them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure. For my heart was pleased because of all my labor. And this was my reward for all my labor. And so I've worked hard. I've accumulated this wealth. I can have it. I can do it. And so I'm going to. And see if that will provide me some, you know, some joy in life, some satisfaction. Well, let's look in detail at what he did. Verse 3 of chapter 2. I explored with my mind how to stimulate my body with wine while my mind was guiding me wisely and how to take hold of folly until I could see what good there is for the sons of men to do under heaven the few years of their lives. I enlarged my works. I built houses for myself. I planted vineyards for myself. I made gardens and parks for myself. I planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made ponds of waters for myself from which to irrigate a forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves, and I had homeborn slaves. I possessed flocks and herds larger than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. I collected for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I provided for myself male and female singers and the pleasures of men, many concubines. Then I became great and increased more than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. And my wisdom also stood by me. And so while he's collecting all these things and experiencing all these things, he's thinking, you know, my wisdom is with me. I'm thinking about it. I'm making an evaluation about this. I'm trying to determine whether this really brings satisfaction to life or not. The result of that and the conclusion is found in verse 2. I said of laughter, it's madness. And of pleasure, what does it accomplish? And then verse 11. Thus I considered all my activities which my hands had done and the labor which I had exerted. And behold, all was vanity and striving after wind. And there was no profit under the sun. And so after experimenting with pleasure for some time, after just heaping up unto himself, you know, all sorts of material things and anything that would be pleasing to the eye or the body, he said, there's nothing to this. There's just nothing to it. It's just striving after the wind. It's vanity. It's profitless. It's worthless. It doesn't bring any real meaning. People are still experimenting with these same things today. Maybe in modern form. But we're still accumulating to ourselves things that are pleasing to the eye or things that are pleasing to the body or things that make us feel good about ourselves or whatever they are. Now, they might take a modern form, but we're still experimenting with these same things today. No doubt some of these things, if used in the right way, do bring joy. And life would be unfulfilling without them. Now, I gathered together men singers and women singers. I like music. I like all kinds of music. That does bring us joy. And there are other aspects of, you know, the things that he mentions here that bring us some joy and happiness if used in the right way and kept in the right perspective. But these things are not an end in themselves. Pleasure is not an end in itself. These things may bring us joy, but only for a little while. And the joy that it brings or the pleasure they bring is only temporary at best. Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 25 speaks of the temporary pleasure of sin. I use this as an illustration. We're very much like this in some ways, I think. We have a little dog at home. His name's Roscoe. You've heard me talk about him before. It's a little dachshund. And sometimes when we leave, we have to leave the house for a while. We'll put Roscoe in his crate. We call it a crate. It's really a cage. We just can't bring ourselves to say it's a cage, so we call it a crate or a bed. We might say, get in your bed. And so he doesn't really always want to go. Sometimes he does. Sometimes he doesn't want to go, so we'll have a little treat. It's beef flavored. I don't know that there's any real beef in it, but it's beef flavored. Go, Roscoe, get a treat. Get in your bed. Get a treat. He'll hop up in that bed. And he'll gobble that down and we'll close the door. Well, what's he done? He's exchanged his freedom. He's exchanged his ability to roam around the house for that momentary treat. It's not in his mouth more than 2 seconds. We got to do better than Roscoe, don't we? We've got to do better than Roscoe. We cannot exchange our life, our health, our well-being, our future, our eternity for a little treat that lasts a little bit. Well, we got to do better than Roscoe. Sure, surely we can do better than that. If we'll just look at life from a different perspective, not from under the sun, but maybe we're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit. Well, he also experiments with wisdom, the pursuit of wisdom. And so in chapter 2, beginning in verse 12, I turn to consider wisdom, madness, and folly, for what will the man do who will come after the king except what has already been done? I saw that wisdom excels folly as light excels darkness. The labor of the wise man, the life of the philosopher, was seen as the very highest calling in the ancient world. And the wise men that came to visit Jesus would have fallen into this category. They were in the pursuit of knowledge and wisdom and insight. They would have been the advisors and counselors of life. They could have advised people, here's what you need to do in order to live a good life. Let me give you some advice that will help you with your problems and enable you to live a successful life. And so he pursued that kind of thing. We know that Solomon was a very wise man indeed, responsible for a great number of the Proverbs, for example, and so forth. But he says, the pursuit of wisdom under the sun, this world's wisdom, is of very little value. Now, it might be of some value, but its value is limited. And so he says, I saw that wisdom excels folly as light excels darkness. And so, yes, it is of some value to have wisdom of this world, but it can't provide the answers to the big questions of life. It just lacks the perspective. Where did we come from? This world's wisdom can't answer that question. Where are we going? The wisdom of this world has no answer to that. What are we supposed to be doing while we're here? Now, it might give us some insight and some good advice, but it can't give us a full answer, a complete answer, a satisfying answer. I heard a funny story years ago that relates to this. A man set out on a quest for the meaning of life. And he sold everything he had. He gave it all up. And he went on a trip to the Himalayas. He heard that there was a guru up on the top of the mountain that could tell him the meaning of life. And so he goes and he climbs the mountain. And by this time, he's got a long beard and his clothes are torn and ragged. And he gets up there and he finally, can you tell me the meaning of life? And the guru looks at him and says, my son, life is a deep well. What? I've come all this way. I've spent everything I've got. Look at me. And you tell me life is a deep well? The guru looks at him and says, life's not a deep well? It doesn't have the answer, does it? The wisdom of this world doesn't have the answers that we need. Oh, it might give us some insight. But it doesn't really have a satisfying answer. Or it can make some suggestions, can speculate, but at the end of the day, it's just not satisfying. Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 18 and 20, that in the wisdom of this world is foolishness with God. So that's verse 21. Since in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not come to know God, God was well pleased through the foolishness of the message preached to save those who believe. And so, as at the end of his pursuit for wisdom and the sort of intellectual quest, he comes to the conclusion that, you know, it's all vanity and striving after wind. That's chapter 2, verse... Well, let's read verses 15, 16, and 17. I said to myself, as is the fate of the fool, it also will befall me. Why then have I been extremely wise? So I said to myself, this too is vanity. For there is no lasting remembrance of the wise man as with the fool, inasmuch as in the coming days all will be forgotten. How will the wise man and the fool alike die? So I hated life, for the work which had been done under the sun was grievous to me, because everything is futility and striving after wind. Well, the third pursuit was the pursuit of wealth, or as it's described here, the fruit of his labor. Chapter 2, verse 18, I hated all the fruit of my labor for which I had labored under the sun, for I must leave it to the man who will come after me. Men sometimes work hard, they work all their lives, building up achievements that will outlive them. It might be a business of some kind, or it might be an estate. It might be some artistic achievement. You know, I'm going to create this painting or this sculpture or build this building, whatever it is, and that's going to outlive me, and people will remember me. Well, the truth is that we can take none of those things with us. No achievement, no accomplishment, no possession will be taken with us. We will all die and we'll have to leave that to someone else. And what if they take a sledgehammer to our sculpture? What if they tear down our building? Or what if somebody paints over our painting? Or what if our son doesn't appreciate our business and he runs it into the ground? Or what if somebody sells off my estate? It's a common tale, isn't it? Well, we see that fairly regularly. Somebody builds up a business and it goes well and he passes it on to his son. Well, he doesn't know how to run the business, doesn't have any interest in running the business. And here, this man's life's work is squandered by those who come after him. And so that's the third area that he pursues. And to this point, the preacher has only noted the futility, the emptiness of life spent in the pursuit of these things. And he's really right about this, isn't he? It's viewed from under the sun, from an earthly perspective. None of these things really can provide lasting meaning to life. We'll just make a couple of observations at this point. One is, we need to understand these things. And, you know, I think especially of our young people, as they're growing up and they're about ready to go out into the world and make their way in the world, you need to understand that pleasure is not going to give you lasting satisfaction. Although there might be some good in it, but it's limited. The pursuit of wisdom, accumulating wisdom. there's value in that, but it's limited. And so don't get caught up in the pursuit of those things and spend all your energy and all your life in that endeavor. And then wealth and material things. Well, there's some value there. Yeah, I mean, it's much easier to live a certain kind of life than another kind of life, but don't get caught up in just the endless pursuit of more and bigger and better and the next thing that's come out. There will always be something more, something just outside your reach. And in the end, it becomes a frustrating pursuit instead of a satisfying one. And so understand these things as you begin to make your way in the world. And don't get caught up in the pursuit of things, the vanities under the sun. And then the second observation is this, that some who do understand these things have just dropped out and wander aimlessly through life. Well, why should I work hard? I'm going to die in the end anyway, so I'd just soon be lazy as work hard. You know? And so some have seen the futility of life and they just drop out and they have no ambition or initiative in life. You know, the preacher doesn't recommend that lifestyle either. Oh, he sees the futility of a sort of a lifelong, all-encompassing a pursuit of these things, but he doesn't recommend dropping out and just wandering aimlessly. That's not his recommendation either. Well, what does he tell us to do? Well, I'll just suggest three things. The first thing is enjoy life while you live under the sun. Enjoy life. A person could read what he has written up to this point and become so pessimistic about it all that he's miserable in life. You know? Oh, you know, here I am, I'm working, I'm doing all of this, I'm just going to have to leave it to somebody else. And he becomes miserable. No, that's not the way to live life. Enjoy life. Look at some of these statements. Chapter 1. Ecclesiastes chapter, chapter 2, verse 24. There's nothing better for a man than to eat and drink and tell himself that his labor is good. This also I have seen, that it is from the hand of God. For who can eat and who can have enjoyment without him? And so, you know, you're keeping God in mind, you're living life within the limits of God's will. But within those limits, enjoy life. Enjoy the blessings that God gives you. That's how to get the most out of life. Look at chapter 3 and verse 12. I know that there is nothing better for them than to rejoice and to do good in one's lifetime. Moreover, that every man who eats and drinks sees good in all his labor. This is the gift of God. And so enjoy the possessions that you have. Enjoy the material things. Now, don't put too much importance on those things, but these things are God's gift to you. And so appreciate them and enjoy them. Look at chapter 5 and verse 18. Here's what I've seen to be a good and fitting, to eat and to drink and to enjoy oneself and all one's labor in which he toils under the sun during the few years of his life which God has given him. For this is his reward. Look, life is too short to spend it being miserable all the time. Ever know anybody like that? Life is too short. Life is short. Enjoy it. This is God's gift. I like chapter 9 and verse 9. Enjoy life with the woman whom you love all the days of your fleeting life, which he has given to you under the sun. This is your reward in life, in your toil in which you've labored under the sun. You have a wife, enjoy this relationship with your wife. Enjoy that. That's God's gift. Again, you know, life is just too short to spend it being miserable. And sometimes people are that way. I think maybe as we get older, we become more and more miserable. Isn't that what he says over in chapter 12 and verse 1? Remember your Creator in the days of your youth before the evil days come and the years draw nigh when you say, I have no delight in them. While you're young, enjoy life. Now, enjoy it within the limits that God has set. Don't live an unrestrained, uncontrolled life. You know, no limits. No, that's not the way to enjoy life. In fact, that's going to bring us some misery. But enjoy life. That's what God has given you these things for. So that's the first observation we'll make. The second thing that he says, and we'll look at the end of the book, is to fear God. Chapter 12, verses 13 and 14. The conclusion, when all has been heard, is this: fear God. The fear of God is a common idea in the Bible. The word itself means, at least when it's making reference to God, it means to stand in awe of Him. The 33rd Psalm in verse 8, let all the earth fear the Lord and let all the inhabitants of the world stand in awe. And so, just think about God. And we stand in awe. We're just in awe of God and His nature and what He's done. We're going to talk about that in just a moment. To fear God means to hold Him in reverence and honor, to be amazed by Him, to revere Him, to respect Him. Those are the ideas contained in this notion of fearing God. And so understand that there is more to our existence than life under the sun. All right, fear God. There is a God out there. You know, He's not under the sun. He's out there. He's in heaven. And we need to fear Him, revere Him, stand in awe of Him, respect Him. And that's the idea. Perhaps we can develop the appropriate fear of God when we think about His nature and His mighty deeds. Think about what God has done. Think about the creation that God has made. And there are times, maybe there are moments when we're maybe at the seaside or in the mountains or maybe out in the, you know, the big sky country. And we look at what God has made, and it's awesome. I know that's an overused word these days, but it is awe-inspiring. Think about God destroying the world by a flood. He developed a nation from Abraham and Sarah. He parted the Red Sea, provided manna and quail and water for the children of Israel in the wilderness. By the power of God, the walls of Jericho fell. Israel conquered the land. He has healed the sick, cleansed the lepers, cast out the demons, raised the dead, especially in Jesus. God is omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent, eternal. There is nothing like Him in heaven, on earth, or under the earth. Fear God. In the context of Ecclesiastes, we might say something like this: that God made us, He's in control of everything, He upholds all things, He gives meaning to our existence, He blesses and curses, He rewards and punishes, He builds up and tears down, He gives life and takes it, all according to His infinite wisdom, power, dominion, mercy, justice, grace, and love. Fear God. And so that's where you're going to find meaning in life. It's not in just looking at life under the sun, although there's some value there. Look toward the heavens. Fear God. And keep His commandments. That's the second thing He says in this passage. Keep His commandments. Let's look at a couple of statements. The 112th Psalm and verse 1. The 112th Psalm, verse 1. Praise the Lord. How blessed is the man who fears the Lord, who greatly delights in His commandments. So what I want you to see from that passage is how the fear of the Lord is linked to keeping His commandments. Or we could look at it the other way. Keeping His commandments is linked to fearing God. If we fear God, we'll keep His commandments. So these two things just naturally go together. In Genesis chapter 22, when Abraham is told to offer Isaac upon the altar, remember, he takes him to the altar and he raises the knife. He's ready to slay his son. The angel stops him, of course. In verse 12, God says, "Do not stretch out your hand against the lad and do nothing from him, for now I know that you fear God." Why did God say, "Now I know you fear God"? What? You've shown your willingness to obey. You see, so our obedience is the natural result of our fear for God. John tells us that the commands of God are not burdensome. Now, the world would have us think that the commands of God are burdensome, that somehow we're going to deprive ourselves of enjoyment in life if we live according to the commands of God, but it's just not so. Do you want to be free from the fear of AIDS? Do you want to be free of the fear of some sexually transmitted disease? Well, observe God's teaching when it comes to sexual conduct. And you're going to have to worry about a sexually transmitted disease. Do you want to be free from the devastating consequences of alcohol? Just think of all the broken homes and broken lives. All the destruction. You want to be free from all that? Well, don't drink. And you'll be free from the devastating consequences of alcohol. Do you want to avoid the consequences of lying? And there are some severe consequences to lying. Well, tell the truth. Do you want to avoid the continual pursuit for frustrating pursuit for more and more? Be content. And so, keeping God's command, they're not grievous. In fact, what the Bible tells us is that they are for our good. There are two statements in the book of Deuteronomy to that effect. Deuteronomy chapter 4, for example, tells us that the commands of God are for our good. And then Deuteronomy chapter 10 as well. And that's verse 12. "Now Israel, what does the Lord your God require from you but to fear the Lord your God, to walk in His ways, to love Him, and to serve the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, to keep His commandments and His statutes, which I'm commanding you today for your good." And so God's commands are for our good. And if you want a life that's free from the consequences that sometimes we bring up, just do right in the beginning. You know, how many times do we get ourselves in trouble because we do wrong in the beginning, then we suffer the consequences, and we look back and think, you know, if I just hadn't told that lie, I'd be a lot better off now. Or if I hadn't just, in that moment, you know, given in to some sort of temptation, I'd be much better off now. Just do what's right from the beginning. It's not hard to do. God's commands are not burdensome. Take some discipline, of course, but as we do them more and more, it gets easier and easier to live within God's will. Judgment is coming. And that's what he says here at the end of chapter, Ecclesiastes chapter 12. God is going to bring every work into judgment. Whether it's secret, whether it's open, God will bring every work into judgment. The judgment is coming. The Bible is very clear about that. Jesus talked about the judgment day. You know, in that day, many will say to me. Paul talked about the judgment day. John talked about the judgment day. The judgment is coming. And we'll give an account of all our deeds, all our words, all our secrets. Are we ready? We're going to be ready for the judgment day. We want to fear God, keep His commandments, and that way we're going to be prepared. And so this is just a lesson, I think especially of our young people, but it's applicable to everybody. Don't get caught up in life under the sun. We're here for a while, but we're going somewhere else. And so fear God and keep His commandments. This is the whole duty of man. Well, if you're here today, not a Christian, we want to give you an opportunity to respond to the invitation. Put your faith in Jesus, the Son of God, as your Savior. Shed His blood on the cross so that you can be forgiven and be numbered among God's children. Repent of your sin. Confess your faith. Be baptized in Jesus' name. And then begin living a life of faithful service to God in the fear of God, keeping His commandments. If you've already become a Christian but your life isn't right, don't get caught up in this world. Just think about that other world, the world where we're going. Do what you need to do to get ready for it. Repent of the sin that's in your life and confess it, and God will forgive. So if we can help you in some way today, we invite you to come as we stand and sing this song together.